Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So, welcome everybody to the next installment of the Distinguished Lecture Series sponsored by the Computer and Information Science and Engineering Directorate at NSF. My name is Rance Cleveland, and I'm the Director of the Computing and Communication Foundations Division within SAIS. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Professor Nancy Lynch from MIT. I debated how to frame my introduction because I have to admit to have that Nancy's been a fixture of the research community as long as I've been aware of computing research. And so I thought I would start with maybe a little a personal note in that regard. So I started graduate school, and I'm hesitant to admit this, but in 1982, and the year is important because in 1982, Nancy and her co-authors published what I think is the most influential paper on theory of distributed systems. So I was a young graduate student and sort of trying to find my way, work my way through the research literature. I was reading a lot of papers and understanding almost none of them. And I remember coming across this paper in probably 1983 or so, and reading it and not really understanding it, but understanding that I'd better understand it because there was something deep and fundamental in the impossibility result of consensus that was proven in that paper. Well, little did I know that that this paper would lead to other papers and other papers and other papers, a lot of them by Nancy, that laid the firm mathematical foundations for understanding distributed computation. So, Nancy is, as I said, a professor at MIT. She also got her PhD at MIT in mathematics. Before that, her bachelor's, her BS, and also in mathematics, Brooklyn College. And she's been at MIT for a number of years, supervising students and conducting truly fundamental and important research in the area of distributed systems. She's won every award that I can think of in the theory of computing community. If I were to list all of these, I would use up most of the hour. And I know you're here to hear her talk, not hear me talk. I will say that she's won at least one of these awards twice. She's also an ACM fellow and a member of the National Academies of both Science and Engineering. I think I'll conclude my introduction with another sort of little aside. From time to time in my career, I've heard Nancy referred to as a force of nature, and this is a testament to her truly astonishing record for years and years and years and years of fundamental results in a variety of the theoretical areas involving distributed systems. However, I sometimes think that that should be flipped around a little bit. Instead of referring to Nancy as a force of nature, I like to think of nature as being a force of Nancy. Again, in recognition of her truly remarkable record and the very important research that she's done. So, without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Nancy Lynch.
Wow, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you for that introduction, Rance, and thank you all for inviting me for this talk. Can you hear me okay? I assume.
Yes.
Okay. So, this talk is going to be on a theoretical view of distributed systems. It's a very broad talk about what I have worked on over decades with many collaborators and students. So basically we've been involved in developing the theory for distributed systems. we're trying to understand distributed systems in mathematical terms. And that includes what they do, what they are able to do, and what the limitations are. And specifically, what is that? Well, it has involved defining mathematical models for problems that are solved in distributed systems and for the algorithms that are used to solve them. Sometimes it's involved developing new algorithms and sometimes considering algorithms, studying algorithms developed by others. It's involved producing proofs of correctness also performance, fault tolerance properties. And then, as Rance mentioned, we've had a lot of work on proving impossibility results and lower bounds. So these are expressing inherent limitations of distributed systems for solving problems. And along the way, we've had to do a lot of work on developing basically concurrency theory type foundations for modeling and analyzing distributed systems. So what kinds of systems? We started out working on distributed data management systems mostly, and more recently we're working on communication systems, both wired and wireless. And very recently, my group is focused on biological systems, which are systems like insect colonies, developmental biology, and brain networks. Okay, so in this talk, does anybody keep their camera on? No, it looks like all the cameras are dead. Oh, well, if somebody could keep a camera on, that would be nice. It's nice to get a little reaction. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to, it's a very broad brush talk. I'm going to talk about work we've done on algorithms for traditional distributed systems, talk about impossibility results, and then very, very briefly, talk about the foundation's work and some of the newer work on algorithms for new types of distributed systems. Okay, so for traditional distributed systems, well, we began our work in this area with a study of mutual exclusion, the costs of achieving mutual exclusion in shared memory multiprocessor settings. This is work with Mike Fisher, Jim Burns, and others. And then we moved from there into studying some abstract distributed network problems, including consensus, approximate consensus, clock synchronization. And so these two papers listed here give some new algorithms for fault-tolerant clock synchronization and fault-tolerant approximate agreement. There's a lot of references that you're going to see on these slides. So assuming that we can post the slides later, you might want to browse some of these papers later on. The first example I'm going to go into in some detail is a paper with Cynthia Dwork and Larry Stockmeyer on consensus in the presence of partial synchrony. Okay, so this is, it addresses the problem of exact agreement in the presence of failures, not just approximate agreement. It's kind of a counterpoint to the Fisher-Lynch-Patterson results that Rance was talking about. I'll go over that result later in the talk, but that shows impossibility reaching fault-tolerant consensus in asynchronous networks. This paper by Dwork, Lynch, and Stockmeyer presents an approach for dealing with delimitation from the FLP paper. Also presents several algorithms that use this approach and tolerate different types of failures and timing uncertainties. Okay. Just as an aside, this paper has been very well recognized lately and has won the Dijkstra Prize, but it wasn't very well cited at the time we wrote it because it was written as a purely theoretical paper. It's been kind of rediscovered lately because it's relevant for things like blockchain algorithms. Okay, so I'll start with some excerpts from the award citation for the Dijkstra Prize. This was written by Dalia Malky. The idea is that this paper is introducing a bunch of models for partial synchrony between synchronous and asynchronous. And these are models in which the consensus problem is solvable. The claim in the citation is that this provided practitioners with the right tool for building fault-tolerant systems. The key is that the safety properties are maintained at all times, despite the impossibility of consensus. And it progress, the thing that gets weakened is the progress condition. That's facilitated not always, but just during periods when the system is stable. Okay, and then Dalia goes on to say that these are the pillars on which modern fault-tolerant systems are built. Okay, so just a quick review, distributed consensus, you have a bunch of processors in a distributed network that have to agree on a value. Every processor starts with some initial preference and they have to agree on some value. But some of the processors might be faulty. People have studied different kinds of failures. The key conditions are everybody has to agree. And if all the processors happen to start with the same initial value, that's the only allowed decision value. This condition is sometimes strengthened to say that any decision in any case must be somebody's initial value. And of course, we also want the algorithm to terminate. We'd like all the non-faulty processors to actually succeed in reaching agreement. So this problem arose originally in two places. It was the database commit problem studied by Jim Gray way back, and the Byzantine agreement problem, where the agreement was on aircraft altimeter readings. That was by Pease, Shostak, and Lamport. Okay, so what does the paper do? It considers a variety of partial synchrony models and a variety of failure models, gave algorithms that always reach agreement, always guarantee the agreement and validity properties, but termination is guaranteed in the case when the system's behavior stabilizes. Okay, so if the system stabilizes for long enough, then we guarantee that agreement is actually reached. So I'll actually go into some detail. The key algorithmic ideas are different processors try to take charge of reaching agreement. And in our paper, they do this in a rotating fashion. This is a paradigm called a rotating coordinator paradigm. And you have to do some work to reconcile what happens if different coordinators try to coordinate decisions. You have to make sure they don't contradict each other. Okay, so here's just a sketch of how it works. Let's look at the simplest case where you have synchronous rounds and just simple stopping failures. So we have messages that could be lost, but after some time, we assume that all the messages get delivered in a timely fashion. Okay, so we have phases, each one some coordinator is in charge of, and we can do it by the coordinator number is the number of the phase mod n. So processor can lock a value with a certain phase number. That means it thinks that the coordinator might decide that value at that phase. And here's what happens during the phase k under the control of some coordinator. First, everybody sends the coordinator what it thinks are acceptable decision values. That means they don't hold a lock on something different and actually it's known to be somebody's initial value. So everybody sends their acceptable values and then the process picks a value that is acceptable to a majority of the processors, broadcasts that value, and all the recipients lock that value for the current phase. Okay, now anybody who locked the value sends an acknowledgement to the coordinator. Now remember, these messages could get lost. But if the processor coordinator receives the majority of acknowledgements, then it's able to decide on that value. And then round four is just a bunch of cleanup stuff going on. Okay, so that's basically the flavor of all these protocols. It's just repeating it again. And this is depicting the communication pattern. So some of these ideas come from Skeen's three-phase commit, is inspired by Dale Skeen's earlier work on three-phase commit. And then somewhat later, Lamport's Paxos consensus protocol uses very similar ideas to reach agreement. Okay, I should say that there's a difference, with an important difference in Paxos protocol is it has more concurrency. It doesn't use a strictly rotating coordinator, but it allows different coordinators to make attempts concurrently. But it's still the majority checking discipline that's used to manage the conflicts. Okay. All right, so that's the first example. The next two contributions I'm going to talk about are mostly about modeling and proofs for algorithms that had arisen in the design of distributed systems, not so much about new algorithms like the previous example. So both of these deal with distributed data management, which was the main focus of our work for many years. After that, I'll look at one more algorithmic contribution that I like. It's called the Rambo algorithm, which is designed to implement atomic shared memory on a dynamically changing platform. And that can be regarded as another precursor to blockchain style algorithms. Okay, so let's look at concurrency control algorithms for nested transactions. Okay, so So my collaborators and I spent several years, mostly in the 80s, trying to use theoretical approaches to understand and generalize and prove correctness of concurrency control algorithms for implementing atomic transactions. It's a central problem of distributed data processing. Okay, mostly that work had been done by systems people, and there was not all that much theory yet. So some more background, transactions. A transaction, you probably know, you can think of it as a sequence of operations, typically just read and write operations, that are supposed to appear as if they're executing as one indivisible unit. And then a collection of transactions are supposed to appear to execute in some sequential order. Concurrency control just refers to algorithms that are used for implementing atomic transactions. So the main leader in this field, and we began, was Turing Award winner Jim Gray. And Bernstein and Goodman followed on, beginning work on an abstract, a formal theory for some types of transactions. Okay. Then there were a lot of systems papers that had implementing algorithms represented and little theory there. I didn't mention, but the extensions of transactions to the nested case, that was done by Barbara Liskov, another Turing Award winner. She extended the idea of transactions to allow them to have a nested tree structure where transactions have child transactions, all the way down to leaf transactions. And any transaction could abort during an execution, and then its parent can accommodate. It could learn about the abort and react by, for example, trying something else. And the key condition there is that every set of sibling transactions should execute in some order. Each sibling should appear atomic. So this is a very flexible programming discipline that Liskov included in her Argus distributed programming language. So that work seemed really interesting, but it was complicated. The new nested transaction concept and all the algorithms for implementing it had no theory, just the descriptive systems papers and the implementations. So our work involved trying to model these things, the transaction requirements and the algorithms mathematically. Along the way, we ended up generalizing some existing algorithms from the single level transactions to nested case. And then we were actually able to push this to the point of proving correctness of these algorithms. Okay, so we wrote a book that included all of this work. It's based on a whole series of research papers. So what we did was develop a general theory for nested transactions. It included an atomicity theorem that provided one method for proving correctness of concurrency control algorithms. It's kind of a compositional method. And then we did all of this, these types of algorithms. There's lock-based algorithms, which is what was used in the Argus system. But there's also algorithms that are based, do concurrency control based on timestamps on a combination of the two. There's optimistic algorithms. Orphan management algorithms deal with what happens to child transactions of aborted transactions. And there's algorithms that involve replicated data. We did all this in terms of a mathematical framework called IO automata. So we developed a model for asynchronous systems with interacting components. And this was being developed at around the same time, but we were able to use that as the basis for all of this modeling and verification. So what I've learned is that recently the effort of verifying at least safety properties of complex systems of this sort has become quite popular in systems communities. Some of that work involves not mathematical proofs of the sort that we did, but code level verification using interactive theorem provers. So our work is different. is that in that it's based on abstract models and our proofs are mostly by hand. Of course, abstract proofs could also be done with theorem provers, and we did a few of those. Okay. All right. So following the same style as for our nested transactions work, we studied other algorithms in the distributed data systems database community. Again, trying to understand how they worked in a mathematical way and prove their key properties. So here's the next work that we did. We tackled the notion of distributed shared memory, which is basically a shared memory abstraction implemented in a distributed network. We focused on a system called ORCA, which was developed by Ball, Kashuk, and Tannenbaum. The ORCA system included some interesting algorithms to achieve distributed shared memory, but the algorithms were kind of complicated. It wasn't obvious that they were correct, or why they were correct, so it seemed like a good subject for theoretical work. Okay, so what did we do? We considered an algorithm to implement sequentially consistent read-update shared memory using a basic communication service that had a combination of broadcast and point-to-point communication. This was as in the Amoeba operating system. So this algorithm was based on the ORCA system, which was used for writing applications for clusters of workstations. So ORCA divided up the work into two parts. It first defined an abstract multicast channel, which has very strong ordering and causality properties. And then it implemented sequentially consistent memory over an arbitrary multicast channel using a partial replication strategy. You had copies of the data at some of the nodes. You can read any copy, but you have to update all copies. And they also implemented the multicast channel over their basic broadcast and point-to-point communication services using a protocol that's based on sequence numbers. Okay, so what did we do? Well, we specified the message delivery and the ordering requirements of the multicast channel mathematically. Okay. Then we defined an algorithm like theirs, a sequence number based algorithm to implement the multicast channel over basic communication services. And we tried to prove the algorithm correct, but it didn't work. We discovered an algorithmic error in the ORCA implementation. It was something subtle. They didn't piggyback certain needed sequence numbers on some response messages. Okay, the error was fixed in the algorithm and in the actual system. It also had to be repaired. In fact, the system developers were very surprised that this bug was found using theory. They were kind of skeptical of the theoretical efforts at the time, but yes, trying to do a proof unearthed the error. And then of course we could complete the proof. Okay. So, all right, so this is what I just said. We defined this algorithm and proved it correct. And then for the higher level, we defined then a version of the partial replication algorithm to implement the sequentially consistent memory over the multicast channel, which is a generalization of the ORCA algorithm. And we developed a proof technique, a little bit new, for proving sequential consistency. And that was all based on IO automata, composition, abstraction techniques. The things that we were studying in terms of basic foundations for concurrency were exactly what we were using for proving these real algorithms. Okay. All right, so summary of just these last two parts is, what did we do? We looked at a bunch of existing distributed systems. We used IO automata-based formal methods to model and verify many such systems, especially the kind that had strong consistency requirements for the data. And we specified the properties that were required, defined abstract versions of the systems, and proved the algorithms correct. That meant we had to clarify ambiguities, and we found and fixed some errors, the one I told you about, also at least one other in an existing system. Okay. All right, so one more algorithm example is the work on reconfigurable atomic memory. So here I'm going to talk about this last paper by Gilbert Lynch and Schwarzman on RAMBO, which is a reconfigurable atomic memory service that works in dynamic networks. So this is just a picture from a news story on this, which shows a centralized memory brain being implemented on a bunch of distributed mobile devices. Okay, so our goal is to implement atomic read-write shared memory in a dynamic network setting. So atomic memory is what? It's supposed to look like a centralized shared memory to everybody who accesses it. The participants can join and leave and fail during computation. That's a dynamic network. Examples would be mobile networks and peer-to-peer networks. We want high availability, low latency, and we want to maintain atomicity in all cases. But you know, we'd like good performance when there's some limits on the changes. So examples that inspired this work are soldiers in a military operation that don't have any fixed infrastructure that they're using, like in the first, like the war in Afghanistan, where you have a bunch of soldiers going into an area and they don't have any communication infrastructure. So they have to either bring their own on a truck or else there ought to be some techniques that can run just on the mobile devices. Okay, the starting point for this work was a work on static networks by Atiyah Barnoy and Dolev. So basically the protocol for maintaining atomic memory in a static network involve quorums of processors. You can think majorities if you like, but they basically allowed some read quorums and some write quorums. The key condition, as for majorities, is every read quorum has to intersect every write quorum. They replicated the objects everywhere with tags indicating versions. And then their algorithm to read was contact a read quorum, determine the latest version, propagate it to a write quorum, and return it. To write, you contact a read quorum to determine the latest tag, choose a bigger tag, and write your value with that tag to a write quorum. Okay? So they're both these sort of two-phase protocols. You can optimize so that you don't need to always propagate for a read. That saves some communication and time. So in this algorithm, the nice thing is that the operations can all proceed concurrently and they can interleave at a very fine granularity, just the individual sends and receives. And yet you still get atomicity out of the entire algorithm. Okay, so now the RAMBO algorithm inspired by this one. First of all, RAMBO stands for reconfigurable atomic memory for basic objects, which is read-write objects. It also stands for a soldier in a military setting, but whatever. The RAMBO is going to use, it's going to be similar, but now it's going to use separate configurations. Each configuration has a set of members, which are just some set of processors, and has read quorums and write quorums. Okay, so instead of just having one configuration as in the Atiyah Barnoy Dolev algorithm, now you have a set of possible configurations. Okay, the objects are replicated now, not everywhere, but just at all members of a configuration. The reads and writes just access quorums of that configuration. And that works the way it did in ABD, Atiyah Barnoy Dolev. And that's fine at handling small and transient changes. But if you want to have more permanent changes, you have to reconfigure to a new configuration, which means moving the object copies to a member, to members of the new configuration. Okay, so the algorithm at a high level is just divided into the main algorithm that does all reads and writes and handles the new configurations, and a reconfiguration service that basically determines the new configurations. The reconfiguration service just supplies a consistent series of configurations, and it can be triggered by, you know, some external administrator decides now it's time to start a new configuration. The main algorithm does all the other work. It handles the reading and writing of the objects, removes the old configurations, and then the reads and writes, the trick is that the reads and writes use all the currently active configurations. Okay, so instead of just trying to synchronize one configuration at a time, you might have some overlap, during which period of overlap, you simply have the reads and writes do a little extra work by using both configurations. Okay, so the reads and writes do a two-phase protocol that's like the ABD protocol, collect object information from read quorums. But now it's not just one configuration, it's all the currently active configurations. And then in phase two, it propagates the latest object information to the write quorums of all the known active configurations. And you can have lots of reads and writes going on concurrently, just as in ABD. You get atomicity as before. And the termination is a kind of a fixed point condition, which involves a quorum from every known active configuration. So while you're doing this, new configurations can, you can learn about new configurations, and then you have to use them too. But at some point you'll have a fixed point where you've satisfied the condition for every configuration you know about. And then you have this protocol to remove old configurations. Turns out that's also a two-phase protocol. It's kind of cute. In phase one, for every old configuration, everything but the latest that you know about, you tell a write quorum of the old configuration about the new one. And you collect the latest object information from the old configuration. In phase two, you just propagate that latest object information to a write quorum of the new configuration. Okay, so now you have reads and writes and garbage collection all going on concurrently, interleaving at a fine granularity, and you still get atomicity. So it's kind of a neat algorithm. Okay, and then, well, what do you do about implementing reconfiguration? So that you can use consensus. Just use consensus to determine the successive configurations. That's a heavyweight mechanism, but we don't use it on every operation. We just use it for occasional changes of configuration. So you're not delaying the read and write operations. Okay. And you can implement consensus using the DLS paper or Paxos. And all this used IO Automata again, actually a timed version of the IO Automata model that took into account time delays. And there's a nice method if you have to prove atomicity for a data system, is a nice method based on partial orders that's described there and used in many other places. Okay. All right. So that's what I wanted to say about algorithms. Gee, it's odd not to have feedback and pauses for questions, but I guess you can't do that in this format. Okay, well, I'll go on. In the next part, I'm going to talk about some of the selected impossibility results. Try to give you the flavor of these results. So the starting point here is that distributed algorithms have very strong inherent limitations. Why? Because they have to work in settings where processors only know what's happening locally, and there's all this uncertainty about what's happening when, and there can be failures. So once you have theoretical models, as we do for the algorithms, you can actually prove that these limitations hold. So the starting point for me in this area was a nice little paper by Kremers and Hibbard way back in 1976. As far as I know, that's the first impossibility result for distributed computing. So these were my colleagues at University of Southern California at the time. The work was in a shared memory setting. They looked at a setting with Boolean shared variables, arbitrary operations, not just reads and writes. And the problem they considered was fair mutual exclusion. Processors can come in, they want the resource, and you want this to be fair, so everybody that requests the resource should eventually get it. Turns out that, and they proved that it's impossible for this to work, it's unsolvable for two processors with a single Boolean shared variable. No matter how powerful an operation you did on the on this variable, two processors can't arbitrate to get fair access to a resource using a Boolean shared variable. So, So their proof is based on constructing a collection of executions and showing that one of these has to lead to an incorrect result. They use the fact that the processors will behave the same in two executions in which their own states and the shared memory contents are the same, regardless of the internal states of the other processes. So this is kind of a light bulb going off. Oh, you could prove this type of limitation based on this limitation of locality. I should apologize because I'm mixing the terms process and processor, but it's mixed in the research literature. So I'll mostly say process now for the impossibility results. Okay, so I'm going to do a quick tour of a little lower bound on the number of shared variables needed for mutual exclusion. And then I'll look at lower bound on the time to reach consensus. And that's warming up to the FLP result for the impossibility of distributed consensus in asynchronous systems. Okay, and then if there's time, I'll talk briefly about the CAP theorem, which is somewhat more recent. Okay, so first, our work on mutual exclusion. We started working on mutual exclusion. First, we focused on the size of the shared memory and tried to generalize from Kremer's and Hibbert's results. We got results about n processes instead of two processes. So that's in the first paper on this slide. The second one is the one I'll talk about now. This gives you a bound not on the size of a shared variable, but on the number of shared variables. And now we're looking at shared variables that just support reads and writes. So this was appeared in 1993, but actually this was proved way back 10 years before. So this actually gives an important limitation on the power of read-write shared variables compared to variables with more powerful operations. If you try to solve the same problem with more powerful read, modify, write operations, one variable is enough. Okay, so here we go. Mutual exclusion for n processes using read-write shared memory requires at least n separate shared variables. And this is true even if you don't require fairness. So, the Kremer's and Hibbert result doesn't apply here. You just require the system to keep making progress. If there's someone who wants a resource, someone should get it. We allow every process to read and write all the variables. And the variables now can be not just Boolean, but unbounded size. So this is a very permissive setting. You just have to try to make progress. Everybody can read and write all the variables, unbounded size variables, and still you can't solve the problem. And I'll just show an example why you can't do it with two processes and only one shared variable. Okay, suppose you have two processes, P1, and P2, and they solve mutual exclusion with progress using just one read-write shared variable I'll call X. Okay, so let's look at this scenario. This is how these proofs go. You construct scenarios that had contradictory requirements. Suppose process one arrives. Nobody's around. Process one then comes in by itself, wanting the resource. So by the progress requirement, it has to be able to get it. Somebody wants the resource, somebody has to get it, and only process one is around. Okay, along the way, I claim that the process must write to the shared memory. Why? Because if it didn't write anything, the other process wouldn't know it was there. It wouldn't know that it had advanced from outside the system into the critical region. So if process two then came in, it should be able to get the resource because it thinks it's alone. And then they both have the resource that would contradict mutual exclusion. Okay, so here's a picture. Process one arrives. It has to write to the shared variable, and then it has to eventually get the resource. Okay, so now let's consider an execution in which process one pauses right here, just before when it's ready to write. It's in a state where it's about to write. And at that point, let's let process two arrive. And it arrives just when process one is paused. Process one hasn't written, so process two thinks it's alone and it gets the resource because it can't see process one at all. Along the way, it has to write the shared variable, same reason as before. Okay, so it comes in, gets the resource, and now at this point, so we're just looking at this branch of the execution. At this point, let's let process one resume. The first thing it does is to write the shared variable. But what does it do? It overwrites whatever process two wrote there. So now process two's presence isn't visible any longer. Okay, so it overwrites whatever process two wrote there. And then process one can't tell process two is there. So it will behave exactly the way it did in the original execution, advancing and getting the resource. It will overwrite, and then it gets the resource. And at this point, you have two processes in the critical section, and you violated the mutual exclusion condition. Okay, at this point, I usually look to see if people are more or less following, but I can't see any of you, so oh well. Okay, so it's a contradiction. If more processes, you need more variables. And it's the same kind of argument. For n processes, you need n shared variables. It's more intricate, the construction, but it uses the same ideas. Writing to a shared variable overwrites the previous contents, and then a process can see only its own state and the values that it actually reads from the shared variables. So using those facts, you get this extended impossibility. Okay. So moving along, I'm going to look at two results on consensus. I'm listing several papers. The first three are for the synchronous model. The first one is the lower bound on the time for consensus in the synchronous model. The next paper actually extends that to K-set consensus, where you can agree on K values instead of one. And this one is a cute paper that gives unifies many impossibility proofs for distributed consensus problems. And then I'll talk about the FLP result. Okay, this is just the same slide as before, defining the consensus problem. Recall, everyone starts with a value. They have to agree on a value in the set. And they have to satisfy the agreement property and a validity property that says if they all start with the same value, that's the only allowed decision value. Okay, so the lower bound on the number of rounds for consensus in synchronous systems. Okay, the starting point here was to notice that all the known algorithms for fault-tolerant agreement in synchronous systems had used at least F plus one rounds where there's F possible failures. And so you wonder why is that, does that have to be the case? So it turns out that's inherent, that F plus one rounds are actually needed in the worst case, even if you're only talking about simple stopping failures. Okay, so all right, proof idea. Assume that for contradiction that you have an F round agreement algorithm that tolerates F failures. And we'll assume, to make things simple, but this is all without loss of generality, that you have an n node complete graph. The decision set is just 0 and 1. Decisions are reached at the end, and everybody sends something to everyone else at every round. Okay, so these are just for simplicity. Okay, so let's just look at the base case. And I'll just give a hint at the next case. So the base case is just, you can't have an n process one fault stopping agreement algorithm that always decides at the end of round one. Okay, so you need at least 2 rounds to tolerate one failure, is what this is saying. How do we know this? Okay, proof by contradiction. Suppose you have an algorithm for n processes that only works in one round and tolerates one failure. Okay, so this is a new kind of argument. You construct a whole chain of executions to get the contradiction. So, I mean, in the last examples, you just saw particular executions, but here you're going to systematically construct a whole chain of executions. Each execution in the chain has at most one failure. The first execution will be designed so that it has to have decision value 0, and the last one would have to have decision value 1. But any two consecutive executions in the chain are going to look the same to some process that's non-faulty in both of the executions. So what does that mean? It means that process has to decide the same in both of those executions. So those two executions must have the same unique decision values. So you're creeping your way from all zero, from guaranteed 0 decision to guaranteed 1 decision, but at every step along the way, you have to maintain the same decision. So you get a contradiction that way. How might you do this? Okay, start with an execution where everyone has input 0 and there are no failures. And end with an execution where everybody has input 1 and there are no failures. Okay, so here's everybody with 0 initial values. Everyone succeeds in communicating with everyone. And we know the final decisions have to be 0. So I'm going to try to work my way to a similar execution where they all start with 1. Okay, so I'll start with this initial execution. And now I'm going to creep slowly toward the other end of the chain. My first execution in the chain will involve removing the 1 message from process 1 to process 2. So that's missing here. Okay, so these two executions look the same to everybody except process 1 and process 2. So they're going to decide the same in both executions. So again here, 0 is the only possible decision value. Okay, next execution. All right, now you can remove the message from 1 to 3. You still have processes that can't tell the difference between now these two, and so they will decide in the same way. Right. And finally, you remove the message from 1 to 4 and still indistinguishable to some non-faulty process. And you just keep going. But once you've removed all of process 1's messages, you have to do something else. You change process 1's input from 0 to 1. Now you can do that because process 1 isn't sending any messages. So no one else can tell the difference whether process 1 started with a 0 or started with a 1. Okay, so in one step, we change the value. So now we can't, so now I want to change the value for 2, but I can't just start removing messages from 2. Why? Because we're only allowed to have 1 failure in each execution, and already process 1 has failed because all of its messages are missing. So now we can't just say, let's let process 2 fail as well. So instead, we first replace the missing messages 1 at a time until we get this kind of a setup where process 1 isn't faulty anymore, but starts with a 1 and everyone else starts with a 0. So now I think you can see the pattern. We do the same, play the same game to change the initial value of process 2 and then do process 3. And eventually we reach the end of the chain where everybody has input 1. tiny, tiny changes at every step in this chain maintain the decision value because the consecutive executions look the same to someone. Okay. All right, so this continues. You have a second theorem that says there's no process, end process to fault, stopping agreement algorithm in which everybody decides at the end of round two. And you just have a more complicated chain. We're gonna have a chain of executions. Now we're allowed two failures at each execution in the chain. Again, we start with all zeros and no failures, end with all ones and no failures, and maintain the property that each pair of consecutive executions is indistinguishable to some non-faulty process. Okay, so for example, how would we change the process one's initial value from 0 to 1? Well, okay, we want to work toward killing process one at the beginning of execution so we can change its initial value. Okay. All right, well, how are we going to remove all of process one's messages? We can remove all of its round two messages just the way we did before, one by one. But we have this little problem. We can't then start removing its round one messages because suppose, for example, we removed the round one message from process one to process two. It wouldn't look the same to anybody. Those two executions would not look the same to anybody because removing this one message still allows process two to tell everybody about the failure. Okay, so you have this picture. Either the message is there and process two can tell everyone he got the message, or the message is not there and process two can tell everybody that he didn't get the message. So it's more complicated, and the trick here is just to use more steps to remove the round one message from 1 to 2. And in those steps, you have to fail both process one and process two. So part of this is removing all of P2's round two messages one by one and replacing them one by one. I'm not gonna go through any more details like that, but it's a more complicated chain involving two failures at each step. Okay. So, all right, finally, I get to the most famous result that Rantz mentioned, reaching consensus in asynchronous systems. Excuse me. So the theorem is, in an asynchronous distributed system in which at most one process may fail by just simply stopping without any warning, it's impossible for the non-faulty processes to reach agreement reliably. So this impossibility holds even if this at most one process that ever fails and the fail process just stops. This is quite surprising. It seems counterintuitive because if you have so many processes and we know that at most one is going to fail, then couldn't all the rest of them manage to ignore that process that might have failed, agree, and then later tell the remaining process what the answer is in case he hasn't actually failed? certainly seems so, but that doesn't work. And the proof goes like this, by contradiction. Suppose you have a one fault tolerant asynchronous algorithm that solves consensus. And again, we just use the problem requirements to show that something has to go wrong. Okay, the value set can still be just binary. Okay, so let's look at an execution now. It's not proceeding round by round, this is asynchronous. An execution now is a sequence of steps where in one step, one process gets one message, updates its state, and sends out a finite number of other messages which go on to the channels. Okay, they're not delivered yet. It's just somebody receives a message and sends a bunch of resulting messages. Okay, we can assume that every message that's sent eventually gets delivered, but we don't have any time bounds here. This is asynchronous. So this execution produces a sequence of configurations of the system, global configurations of all the processes and all the channels. Okay, If you have an execution in which everybody starts with zero, the only allowable decision is zero, and the same for one. If you have mixed inputs, you're allowed to have either decision. And the core of the argument is to prove that the algorithm has to have a certain kind of pattern of configurations where a decision can get made. A pattern consisting of four configurations, let's call them C0, C1, D0, D1. So D0 results from C1 just by having a particular process I receiving a particular message M. Okay, configuration D1 results from configuration C1 in the same way, same process I receiving the same message M. And now the relationship between C0 and C1 is C1 follows from C0 in one step where some process PJ receives a message M prime. Okay, so we have this funny configuration, a set of configurations, and D0 determines that the final decision will be zero. It's called zero valent. The only decision that's possible after this configuration is zero. The only decision that's possible after this configuration is one. So somehow a decision is getting made in this very simple way. We're localizing a decision to a particular pattern of configurations. It turns out to get to this point, you make an argument that says, if you never have this kind of a pattern, you could make the algorithm continue executing forever, all processes continuing to take steps and no one ever deciding, which would contradict the termination requirement. So yeah, eventually you get down to this. And now you just have to consider two simple cases. Suppose these are two different processes. I and J are two different processes. Well, okay. Then you're looking at a situation where a different process receives some message, process I receives some message. What happens if you let process J receive message M prime after D0? Well, since it's after D0, you still have to be zero valent because you've already determined that the decision has to be zero. So we have, if we deliver M to PI and then M prime to PJ, you get zero valence. But if you do it in the other order, you get one valence. But these are two steps that happen at completely different processes. So the relative order can't possibly matter. You know, I'm receiving a message here, I'm receiving another message there. In either case, I just put some output messages on the channels. Doesn't matter what order that happens in. So it can't be two different processes. So now you're down to a case where they must be the same process, I equals J. And the only thing that's happening here is I could be receiving one message M or a different message M prime. And somehow that's going to make the difference. But suppose you started from C0. So now the key is we have a failure to play with. We're trying to tolerate a single failure. So what you can do is just say, fail process I. Everybody else can take steps from this configuration. And we know that since you can tolerate the failure of this one process I, they eventually have to reach a decision. But if you apply that same execution from T0 or D1, you'll still get the same decision. But we know that anything after D0 is supposed to reach a decision of zero, and after D1 is supposed to reach a decision of one. Other processes can't distinguish which of these cases they're running in because we're not looking at the internals of process I. We're just looking at everybody else. So this yields a contradiction because they can't distinguish a situation where they have to decide zero from a situation where they have to decide one. Okay, so I suggest if this looks kind of mysterious, that this is a paper you probably want to take a look at. Okay, now I'm supposed to finish precisely at 12.
That's desirable. I think we have the Zoom, as it were, as opposed to the room until 12:30. But okay. We would like to leave some time for questions.
Well, all right. So I think I'll skip the CAP theorem part and probably the wireless network part and just skip to something near the end of the talk. So here, the consensus, the upshot of this is it's a very important problem in practice. As I said, for a database commit, for example, and the FLP result shows the limitations on the kinds of algorithms you can hope to find. Now, this problem has to be solved in practice. So what could you do? You could use randomness. You could rely on timing assumptions, or you can very carefully weaken the problem requirements so that you always have agreement and validity, but only require termination when the system behavior stabilizes. So that's what's in fact been done. Okay, so there's lots of other impossibility results that have been proved. I'm going to skip through the CAP theorem. Okay. Oh, foundations. Well, all of this is based on IO automata and things like that. So I'm not sure what to say about that. Maybe I've already said enough. These are papers to look at to review the IO automata framework. And this is just an example of a system described using interacting IO automata, implementing a higher level abstract component, also an automaton. This is illustrating composition and abstraction relations or automata. But we also did timed versions of this. There's a book about that. And probabilistic versions. One was just recognized at Concur last year. This is work mainly by Roberta Sagala on probabilistic automata. Okay, so the algorithms for new distributed systems are basically things we've been working on more recently. And the difference is that in these new types of systems, noise and uncertainty and change predominate. So we're looking particularly at wireless networks and biological systems. So, but it's the same type of research again. Again, we're looking at abstract models for problems and algorithms, new algorithms, ways to prove correctness and performance properties, impossibility results, and there's still work needed on general foundations for these very new types of systems. So I'm going to skip the wireless networks entirely. It's really fun stuff, but I'm out of time. So hopefully we can post the slides. So if people are interested, they can take a look. Okay, for biological systems, I'll just say a few words. The kinds of distributed algorithms we've been looking at are insect colonies, a little bit on developing organisms, and quite a bit more now on brain networks. These are very simple models. I mean, the components are rather simple. The algorithms tend to be fairly simple, not elaborate. The goals of this work are both to try to help understand biological systems in a new way as algorithms, but also feedback can go the other way. Once you understand how the biological systems operate, sometimes you can get new ideas for engineered algorithms, like machine learning algorithms can result from better understanding of the brain operation. Okay, these are some references on our insect colony work. Problems we've looked at have included task allocation, searching problems, a very interesting consensus problem, agreeing on a new nest, and problems where insect colonies have to estimate how many other insects are around. Actually, where we've been publishing some of this work in biology journals. And then our recent work on brains uses a stochastic spiking neural network model We study problems like winner take all, which is a kind of leader election. It's a problem of focus and attention in the brain. Ways of coding concepts in neural networks, and ways of learning. And here's just a sampling of some of our recent papers on that. Okay, so the conclusions are that we've worked on a theory for distributed systems to help understand capabilities and limitations. These are the different types of work that's been involved. And this work has covered many kinds of systems over the years, starting with distributed data management systems and then moving through communication systems and currently different kinds of biological systems. But it's the same kind of aims, the same lens, algorithmic lens that we're applying to all of these different areas. And there's still a lot more to do for those of you who are interested in research, especially in these newer areas. And I have to thank my literally hundreds of collaborators on all of this work. And thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Nancy. And indeed, it is unusual giving a talk in this new normal situation, as it were. Of course, now we would all be a clapping. I have to clap for everybody on behalf of everybody else, including not only the people who are on the Zoom meeting, but also the people who are attending via the webinar mechanism, as well as on YouTube. So this is broadcast on YouTube. So I'll open the floor for questions now. Those who are attending, if you have a question, please use the Q&A feature in Zoom, and I'll moderate the questions and read them out. I'll maybe get things started though while people start marshaling their questions. I'm curious in particular in the sort of biological settings that you talked about before, what adaptations you had to make to the basic theoretical models of distributed computation.
Okay, so we've pretty well moved toward just using synchronous models in those cases. The models are stochastic. For insect colonies, you basically have a sort of population protocol style model where you have a bunch of insects that may bump into each other, but the insects have a simple kind of state that could put it in different kinds of modes, and the modes would allow them to make certain decisions of the next action with certain probability. Their inputs correspond to what they see in their environment, as well as interactions with other insects. So yeah, I mean, it's a sort of agent-based model with some differences, but we stuck pretty much to keeping everything synchronous just because insects and biological systems have really good notions of time. So there's no reason to think about, you know, arbitrary race conditions as we did in the data system network kind of models. For brain systems, we're using, as I said, stochastic spiking neural networks. So that's networks where you have firing that occurs based on accumulated potential from neighboring neurons. And for us, it's stochastic, so the firing isn't guaranteed to happen when you reach a threshold, but the incoming potential helps to determine a probability of firing. So, I mean, the probability automatically makes the algorithms noise tolerant, because if you're going to work with that type of probabilistic noise, you're going to be able to handle quite a lot of noise and uncertainty.
Okay. So we have a question that came up on the Q&A from you, Eugene. Have you discovered any errors in biological networks?
In real biology? No. Biology seems to work okay. I mean, there are certainly biology papers that show bizarre behavior on the part of real insect colonies, like ants that start walking around in a circle forever until they die. I mean, these are simple state machines and they have bugs.
Bugs
in a
have
matter
bugs.
Of speaking, yeah.
Yes. Well, in fact,
I'm not sure what it would mean to find mistakes in a biological system. They are what they are, I guess.
Right. And so there's a follow-up saying that indeed he was he was interested in these sort of bizarre behaviors that emerge.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can analyze that kind of thing. We haven't done that one, but you can describe, by describing the insects as simple state machines, you can try to reproduce the behavior. Mm-hmm. We're doing a lot of simulations now. rather than plunging right into proving theorems, we're testing out, because there's a lot going on, and you also want to play with the parameter values.
Right, right.
And once we get observed behavior, we try to prove it.
Right. I guess the other thing too, in line with that, is that you in the case of biology, you also have this sort of great, I don't know what the right word is, debugging engine and evolution, that if too many ants start following each other in a circle, then the species is imperiled.
Right.
It tends to
stamp out behavior like that. That's true.
Yeah. I had another, while we wait for more questions to come in, I had another question too. This relates to something you mentioned at the beginning of your talk about the 2007 Dykstra Award paper that was, I guess, published in 88. Is that right? Am I remembering the?
Mm-hmm.
You alluded to the fact that the paper was sort of published and was sat dormant from a practical perspective until, you know, a decade or so later, when it was suddenly picked up. Do you know what led how that happened? What the story was behind?
I guess people needing to build certain kinds of systems. Cloud mm-hmm. storage was a big thing, and they needed to, try to maintain correctness in the face of number of failures of some number of servers. I'm sort of guessing now.
Right. I was just wondering because if something sits for a while, a lot of times people just, you know, rediscover it or without realizing it, or, you know, rediscover something wrong or rediscover an erroneous version. It's really intriguing and also encouraging to me that the systems people in this case were able to uncover and put to good use the results that you've proven.
Partly because there are people like Dalia Malky, Leslie Lamport, who stand between the theory and the system. So they know the theory. And when they see the system's problem, they can call on some of the theory that they learned and apply it.
Right. There was another comment in the Q&A. Alluding to picking up this theme of evolution and saying it would be weird if every species we observed was in an evolutionary equilibrium, no behavioral bugs. And I guess the point's taken. Of course, what evolutionary equilibrium is for the species to die out, I guess. And quite frankly, if you are in an equilibrium, that's probably the equilibrium you'll wind up at, because the environmental conditions will, I'm sure, continue to change even if the species doesn't.
Well, certainly, yeah, there are species like fruit flies that have evolved over many, many generations. And you might think they're in kind of a stable configuration as far as the mechanisms that they use. Some mm-hmm. work by Sakit Navlaka is worth looking at there.
Yep. So I have another question just came in from Funda I'll just read you the question. How do goals and distributed decision-making translate into insect colonies? Do they tend to be more complex? Are partial solutions more acceptable? For instance, perhaps you don't need all or that many, in fact, insects to come to an agreement. Does this enable any simplifications?
I would say yes, that you get algorithms with certain probabilities of failure. But so I'm thinking of an example that we're working on currently, and this is protocols that ants use to find a new nest. So this is a consensus problem, but it's a consensus problem involving random searching and trying to persuade, you know, decide what you think is the best nest and trying to persuade others. And once you decide, then forcing others to follow you. Now, observing in the ant experiments, you observe a certain probability that this doesn't succeed within a short amount of time. So, you know, that kind of probability may be unacceptable in an engineering system. Also, a lot of those errors are self-correcting. Like if you wait a day, all the ants will wind up in the same nest, whereas the initial execution of the algorithm didn't accomplish that. So yeah, I mean, they are noise tolerant and self-correcting, but there's new aspects like short time frame, it succeeds with a certain probability, much longer time frame, it succeeds with a higher probability. So we've been working with insect biologists on this project. And we just submitted a paper to Animal Biology, the journal. And this is based on a simulator which acts just like real ants of a certain species and can mimic the observed behavior very closely that the experimental biologists have found. But now we get to play with the simulation and see what else we can make these species do.
So do the just out of curiosity, what causes these decisions to be made that we need a new colony? Is there some sort of external environmental stress, or is it?
Yeah, it's kind of like the experimentalist wrecks the nest.
Okay. And so then the ants.
They are forced to go find a new nest.
Okay. So then they're highly motivated to do so, presumably.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They do this in the lab. They also do it in the desert. We visited, that's another story, but we looked at. Some activities of ants in the desert. People in Arizona study ants because they have quite a few local ants available for study.
So do the are these algorithms typically fully decentralized, or is there something like leader election that goes on in these ant?
Nothing is centralized. Okay. Nothing centralized in the brain algorithms, yeah. I mean, there could be some chemical that's flooding dopamine can flood neurons, and that's kind of a global thing. But in the insect colonies, no, there isn't any central direction of any kind.
Okay.
You might think there's a queen, and the queen would tell the others what to do, but she does not.
Okay. I was wondering about that. And so does that mean that like bees and ants are different, or are bees also sort of decentralized, and the myth of the sort of all-powerful queen is sort of not,
it's pretty much the same. The bees are very similar.
Right.
I mean, they're somewhat smarter, have more elaborate behaviors. They can indicate directions, for example.
Okay.
Dancing in a certain way.
Interesting.
Fascinating behavior. Maybe has limitations on how much that contributes to engineering, because the insects work under a lot of constraints that computers don't have. But on the other hand, they also have strategies for resilience, robustness, highly fault tolerant, noise tolerant, and we can learn from their strategies.
Right. Interesting. Okay, well, I think we've exhausted the question. So why don't we go ahead and conclude for today. So I'll just remind NSF attendees that there's a session from, I think it's from 3 to 4 today for sort of a more one-on-one interaction with Nancy. In the meantime, Nancy, thanks for a fabulous talk. It was on the one hand, great to hear, revisit those results that were so influential on me, have been so influential on me throughout my career. And I have to admit, I think we could spend another hour just talking about the insect and brain work too. There's so much interesting going on there. So thank you again. And we'll reconvene at 3 o'clock. And I guess everybody, at least on the East Coast now, can go grab a sandwich or something and have some lunch.
Okay. So thanks again, everybody. Is it the same location?
I think it's a different link. I hope it's. Do you have that link? I'll make sure that you get it. It's a different link.
Somebody resend that to me. I don't remember it now.
Yeah. So Blaine, if you're online, if you could just make sure that Professor Lynch gets the new link, that'd be great. Otherwise, we'll make sure that you get it, Nancy. I'll make sure it's emailed to you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everyone. See you all later.
All right. Bye.